Welcome back to Breast Cancer Update. For the final segment of this program, we visit Naples, Florida, where our CME group hosted a day-long symposium for the Florida Cancer Specialist Oncology Group. Our format focused on faculty panel discussions, and to begin, Dr. Norman Walmark and Dr. Peter Ravden comment on new breast cancer trials, and Dr. Corey Langer provides a contrasting perspective from the world of lung cancer. The focus of this discussion was new strategies in neoadjuvant systemic therapy. Dr. Walmark began by commenting on NSABP B40, a recently launched trial with a unique and provocative design.
This was a long time in the making, B40. In our two previous preoperative chemotherapy trials, B18 and B27, I think we showed that those individuals who have a PCR are the ones who have by far the best outcome. And even in B27, the addition of Taxotere to AC, whereas it doubled the PCR, did not do a whole lot for distant disease or survival. It did lower local regional recurrence. Nonetheless, those individuals who did have a PCR, and twice as many had a PCR with Taxotere as did with AC alone, by far had the best outcome relative to distant disease-free survival and relative to overall survival. So we decided that in B40, we would really like to power the trial based on PCR and use it to develop a molecular taxonomy. So we also decided that we would switch the sequence that we started with, the taxane, which is Taxotere, followed by AC, a doublet of Taxotere Zolota, followed by AC, and a doublet of Taxotere gemcitabine, followed by AC, plus or minus bevacizumab. So it's really a 3x2 factorial, and the reason it took so long to put into application is that we were dealing with basically four companies, and we were dealing with the wonderful help both from CTEP as well as the FDA, which of course, you know, is a matter of an algorithm, just add plus 6 months of pain.
You know, one of the key things about this study that really is different than prior preoperative studies are the endpoints, specifically pathologic CR and what's going on within the tumor. How much quicker are you going to get answers doing it that way compared to the way you used to do it, where you looked at more disease-free survival?
I mean, PCR is a very rapid endpoint.
So, I mean, is it going to move it by up 2, 3, 4 years?
Yeah, absolutely. We reported both on B18 and B27 the PCR outcome. I mean, once the trial is done, you can go ahead and do that. And one of the major objectives is to develop a molecular taxonomy for an association or a pattern of taxane response, perhaps a pattern of bevacizumab response.
One of the interesting things, and, you know, of course, obviously Bev is an issue with lung cancer, is the issue of not having Bev on board when you have surgery. And it was very clever, I think, what the NSABP did is give the Bev early with the taxane, stop
right.
The Bev, give the anthracycline so the Bev washes out.
Right, so you can go ahead and operate.
Right. This whole trend towards neoadjuvant studies that are looking at the tissue, trying to get answers quicker, et cetera, to me it looks like it's starting to happen in lung cancer too, Corey.
Just barely. There's a industry-sponsored trial that is going to compare neoadjuvant to adjuvant, but we really are so fledgling in that regard that we haven't introduced the targeted agents and therefore haven't really had to worry about the Bev issues in patients who still have tumor intact. So the industry-sponsored trial looks like it's going to be docetaxel platinum 4 or aft, 3 cycles pre or post. We're finally doing it. I mean, we're way behind breast cancer in that regard, but it makes sense. The vast majority of patients with lung cancer die of systemic disease, so why not introduce systemic therapy the earliest? We're not at the point where we would feel comfortable, I think, looking at Bev, or for that matter, maybe even other targeted agents in the neoadjuvant.
Although, you know, what Roy Herbst is doing is they're doing biopsies of people with lung cancer. They're actually subjecting them to biologic assays. And then they pick one of four biologic therapies, including erlotinib and sorafenib. It's actually kind of an interesting approach to neoadjuvant therapy.
I should add, for the sake of completeness, that the trial that we just talked about, B40, was for HER2-negative patients.
Right.
The HER2-positive component is going to use the standard sequence of AC followed by Taxol in this case, AC-Taxol Herceptin, AC-Taxol Lapatinib, AC-Taxol Lapatinib plus Herceptin. Again, using PCR as an endpoint with an estimated sample size of 960. And we hope to get that trial online in a fairly expeditious time frame.
Peter, what are your thoughts about the shift in clinical research that's moving more towards looking at tissue and subsetting, et cetera, in breast cancer?
If you look at things, I think we're coming to the end of the era of cytotoxic chemotherapy. In that the 90s was a time when a number of trials came forth and demonstrated that anthracyclines were superior over prior, basically, alkylator-based therapy. And then during this decade, we've seen a number of trials reported that place taxanes thoroughly in the realm of things. I don't think there's another cytotoxic chemotherapeutic agent which is likely to move us strongly forward. I think also, if you take a look at this, each one of these steps has a ratio of about 0.8, or about a 20% step. And Zeno's paradox is where you take half, you walk halfway to your goal, and you know it takes an infinite number of steps. And we're working in kind of a really weak Zeno's paradox here, where we're taking 20% of the steps toward the goal with chemotherapy, and that's an infinite number of steps. So even if gemcitabine adds something, it's just not going to be that exciting unless we can change the paradigm from taking these 20% steps to taking 50% steps. And that's where the targeted agents come in, and that's where all this work in neoadjuvant therapy, metastatic disease, predictors of response is so exciting, because the only way we're ever going to get there within our lifetimes or within this millennia is to actually take much bigger steps. And so what you're seeing now is the trials are being broken out by HER2 status and that kind of thing. And I think that that's going to be, at one level, that looks horrifying, because all of a sudden we're going to have these smaller subgroups of patients. But on another level, it's not going to cost us, because the size of the effects we're going to be looking for, when we're looking for a 20% effect, it takes 3,000 patients to see it these days. But if you're looking for a 50% effect and you do a 3,000-patient study like the North American trastuzumab study, you get P with, you know, 12 zeros after it. The Finns did their study. It had 200 patients, but it was in a targeted population, and it was possible. So I think what's happening is that all this molecular work is allowing the trials to be done in much more selected populations where we can run smaller trials because we're looking for bigger effects. And it's not going to work against us. In fact, it'll work for us, because if you have 10 trials, each one of which get completed over the next few years, and they all take now a 50% step instead of a 20% step, during the next decade, we'll get a lot further than we would with big mixed trials.
It'd be interesting to see the CMIC levels on those Finnish patients. Norm?
I'm not quite as enthusiastic to write a eulogy for chemotherapy as Peter is. But on the other hand, I think that the point is well taken. I think we're heading in the same direction. I think we've crossed the threshold of therapy by empiricism to therapy based on molecular discriminants. The Oncotype DX being a case in point, where your high-risk group really becomes the signature for a chemotherapy that is considered banal, unexciting, pedestrian, and suddenly you have a signature for CMF. So, again, the point is well taken, but I think it applies to chemotherapeutic agents as well as to biologicals.
The next segment of the program includes a panel discussion with Dr. Ravdin, Dr. Harold Burstein, and Dr. Steve Jones. The first topic was the use of non-anthracycline regimens in the adjuvant setting for lower-risk patients, and Dr. Jones began by summarizing the findings he presented at the 2005 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium on a U.S. oncology trial comparing TC, docetaxel cyclophosphamide, to AC.
The objective was to compare disease-free survival between AC and TC in operable breast cancer. About half these women were node negative, half were node positive. We recruited 1,000 patients, so basically 5 years of median follow-up, and we met the endpoint for sort of the final planned analysis, which was based on the number of events. We had a preliminary analysis at about 3 years where there was an emerging difference in favor of TC, but But at 5 years, there really is a very significant difference, p-value 0.01. Dr. Ravden pointed out to me, and I always cite him on this, that the hazard ratio is a nice way of looking at this. There's basically a one-third reduction in risk of having a breast cancer event if you got TC. That's a pretty significant impact. Doesn't really matter whether it's 4 treatments or 10 treatments. It's really this sort of reduction in risk, and it's really pretty significant. And it did translate into a 6% absolute difference at 5 years. We have done one exploratory analysis because of the interest in receptor positive or negative disease and response to adjuvant chemo. About 75% of these women have hormone receptor positive disease. There's no obvious difference between receptor positive or receptor negative disease with respect to benefit from TC. And this is the only exploratory analysis that we did. Overall survival, there is a trend, p-value 0.13. This is usually where I cite Dr. Ravden because, in fact, you know, there's nearly a 25% less chance of dying. So if you put it that way to a patient of TC over AC, most patients would opt for that treatment. But it's not statistically significant. But you can't say there's not some effect on survival. And I personally think if this trial were larger or if we had longer follow-up, that we might well see the survival difference. So the conclusion was that TC is really a new standard non-anthracycline adjuvant regimen. There really aren't many others. There's CMF. There was LPAM from the old days, but no one uses that. There's no reason to think TC is cardiotoxic. And cardiotoxicity is a real issue. And personally, where would I use TC? I would use it in the population of patients we studied in this trial. Node-negative patients, patients with 1 to 3 nodes. It's got good reduction in risk of recurrence. Really as good as doing, you know, AC Taxol or AC Taxotere, in my opinion. We don't have much data in women with 4 or more nodes, so I probably wouldn't pick this there, but really the lower risk patients or patients with cardiac compromise.
Harold? For the most part, my high-risk patients who I'm giving chemotherapy to these days, I'm giving both anthracyclines and taxanes, and the most common regimen we use is Dostens AC followed by paclitaxel. And for lower-risk patients, I think the arguments are, do they need chemotherapy, and what is the role of chemotherapy? And while I find Steve's trial obviously very provocative and well done, I continue to use principally AC. We have such an enormous wealth of experience with AC. It's the foundation for most of the modern treatment regimens that we use. We all are very adept at handling it. And personally, I find it to be not as toxic as TC in the short term. In addition, the side effects that most worry patients are things like alopecia and hospitalization risk, and I actually think those are pretty comparable between AC and TC. So we don't use the AC schedule that was used here. We typically use that dose-dense schedule. Whether that is better or not, I don't know. I think it is a nice option for patients where you want to use chemotherapy and there's a true contraindication to an anthracycline. That would be someone who previously had CHOP chemotherapy for lymphoma or who truly had a pre-existing cardiomyopathy. But it is not a regimen that I use in daily practice.
Just to clarify, so you're saying that because a lot of people are doing that now, using dose-dense AC without a taxane, which of course is being studied in a CALGB trial. What's behind your decision to do that as opposed to non-dose-dense AC?
It's on the assumption that it's the same efficacy and it's just easier for the patients. It is a shorter course of therapy. It's 8 weeks versus 12 weeks, and it is very reliable. And I think that one of the things we learned when we were doing the adjuvant trastuzumab trials where patients got every 3-week AC is we just reminded ourselves how challenging that every 3-week AC is, probably 5 to 15% of patients, their counts haven't recovered by week 3. And with the absence of growth factor support, you see a lot more mucositis and things like that. So I find, again, you don't want to trivialize these things because not everybody does well, but the every 2-week treatment program with AC goes remarkably predictably and efficiently for patients.
Steve, when Harold said he thought TC might be more toxic or difficult for a patient, I saw a bunch of heads nodding. So even though your data suggests that it's less toxic, people have the feeling that it's more toxic.
I find that patients still get a profound amount of neutropenia. They still have alopecia, neuropathy, those kinds of side effects.
Yeah, our experience, and I treated a lot of patients on this trial, was just generally it was just better tolerated. And a lot of patients really don't have much nausea or vomiting with it, which is a big factor. There is a little more neutropenia, and I think the trick is, I like to use oral prophylactic antibiotics, and I think the trick is starting earlier than you would with AC, putting somebody on day 7 or day 8 of oral Cipro for a week really prevents most of the fever and neutropenia. But the rates are still really pretty low. In fact, Frankie Holmes is taking 3 of our U.S. oncology trials and kind of reviewing the rate of fever and neutropenia with first course of AC and taking the data from this trial and just to sort of show in general, to try to prevent fever and neutropenia, you don't need growth factors. I would ask you, I mean, if you just take plain AC and then you add all the expense of growth factors, you've probably increased the cost fourfold. Is that not important in Boston?
It could be. I don't know. What is docetaxel cost compared to doxorubicin? I mean, you know, if you're adding a prophylactic antibiotic, if you're treating them for a longer duration of period, if you're using a more expensive chemotherapy product, I would guess that in this audience, most people who give docetaxel every 3 weeks also provide growth factor support for almost all their patients getting it anyway. So I bet if you did a real-world cost analysis, AC would be cheaper.
What do you think about the observation in this study that the relapse rate was decreased by more than 30%? I mean, again, it was one study, it was 1,000 patients. Obviously, Hal, I think if you believe that was for sure true, you might feel differently.
Well, again, I think that for higher-risk patients, we're giving both anthracyclines and taxanes most of the time, so it's not an issue. So the issue really focuses on lower risk. And for them, I think that all these data collectively underscore the fact that the challenge is, does that woman really need chemotherapy? And I think that when you're talking about a 65-year-old woman who's got hypertension and diabetes and has a low-risk breast cancer, I think the hard question is not AC versus TC. I think the hard question is it worth giving them chemotherapy at all? And if you use a model like Peter Ravden's adjuvant online for a, Peter probably knows he's usually at the tip of his tongue, but for someone who has, you know, is 65 with substantial comorbid illnesses, the benefits of chemotherapy are vanishingly small most of the time for node-negative, hormone receptor-positive, in particular, breast cancer.
Yeah, but you're saying you use AC, and he's saying there's a third fewer relapses if you use TC.
I actually think that TC should be a more popular regimen. Although there's a lot of enthusiasm for dose-dense AC, in fact, it's never been compared. And we don't know from the dose-dense trials whether or not what's going on, which part of the therapy is being improved. And we do know that changing the schedules of taxanes does improve therapy. And so it may well be that the dose-dense therapy, a lot of the additional benefit for the dose-dense 9741 trial actually came from the dose-densification of the taxane part, not the anthracycline part. The other thing which is coming, and it's coming soon, I think, is that we are going to be able to perhaps identify patients who don't particularly benefit from anthracyclines. The story right now from individual trials where people have done topoisomerase 2 is getting very strong. And there is a meta-analysis between these trials. It's almost certainly going to be positive. And so if that meta-analysis is positive, and my guess is it's going to be presented in ASCO next year, and we have a functioning test for topo 2, all of a sudden the regimens that don't include an anthracycline are going to be of renewed and heightened interest.
The impressive results of the U.S. oncology trial evaluating TC reinforces the primary role of taxanes in systemic therapy of breast cancer. A related topic is the newly available formulation of nab-paclitaxel or Abraxane, as commented on by Dr. Burstein.
It is paclitaxel in an albumin shell, and for those of you who saw the New York Times coverage of the ODAC review, I thought it actually was a very nice piece by Andrew Pollack, which highlighted some of the clinical strengths of the drug, but also discussed quite candidly whether or not this was a clinical advance that warranted such payment. At present, I don't know that we have sufficient data to say whether the nanoparticle formulation is clinically advantageous beyond getting around the need for premedicating for hypersensitivity. Some people feel that that is a tremendous advantage and worth any price, and other people are more concerned about the cost there. We have just finished accrual to essentially an identical AC followed by Abraxane dose-dense trial. We had over 60 patients in our treatment program, and we had an early stopping rule looking at whether or not you could give the Abraxane without growth factor support, and you cannot give Abraxane every 2 weeks consistently time after time after time without growth factor support.
So we should do a meta-analysis now. We have two trials.
Right. So our protocol was amended so that all the patients receive growth factor support. cohort, and we'll show these data at ASCO in 07. But again, I don't think for the moment that you don't get around the need for the growth factor if you were even contemplating Abraxane as part of a dose-dense regimen.
I'd be curious from the people in the room here in practice, Lowell, maybe you could comment on this in terms of clinically, how much of an advantage is it in the average patient to avoid pre-medications and the shorter infusion time?
I wouldn't say great enough to justify the cost of the drug in the average patient just the way it's priced. I don't think that's, I mean, there are certainly individual patients that would be a significant consideration, but I would say for the large majority, no, from my standpoint.
Bill?
I think more important, if Abraxane had an advantage in less neuropathy down the road, to me that would be much more important than the pre-medications. What bothers me is a lot of patients that get Taxol and breast cancer and other diseases still are bothered by numbness in their extremities many months, even years later. If Abraxane was found in a large trial not to have that, then that might be an advantage that's worthwhile.
Steve, it's been said that the neuropathy associated with Abraxane goes away quicker and more commonly. Do you think there's data to support that?
That does appear to be the case. I think U.S. Oncology didn't participate in the every 3-week trial, but we did have a fairly large experience with weekly Abraxane. Joanne Blum, one of my partners in Texas, has reported that. And it appeared that it was relatively rapidly reversible compared to paclitaxel, which doesn't go away, or docetaxel, which doesn't go away. I think the jury's still out on that a little bit. You know, when you do these things and you're asking oncologists to do neurologic exams and neurologic assessment, we're not very good at that.
I think you have to be very cautious about that. You know, on the one hand, neuropathy, we've gotten so good at nausea and vomiting and so good at managing marrow suppression that neuropathy stands as one of the big problems. Neuropathy and fatigue beyond anemia are like the biggest clinical problems with chemotherapy treatment. The data from the Abraxane registration study was in the metastatic setting compared against every 3-week paclitaxel. That study was principally done in the former Soviet Union. You have to be very cautious about interpreting reported symptoms in a patient population that more or less had one shot at chemotherapy in a third world country versus what your average denizen of Naples or Fort Myers is going to experience. As part of our study, we actually surveyed neuropathy symptoms quite extensively, and we had a previous trial of about 130 patients who had received dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel, surveyed with the exact same instruments. So we are hopeful that we'll be able to compare those two and comment in more detail on the relative neuropathic toxicities.
Peter, can you summarize your take on this issue that Steve was talking about, which is the question of chemotherapy and ER-positive patients? Is TAC more effective than dose-dense ACT? To me, TAC is compared to a non-taxane regimen. Dose-dense was compared to non-dose-dense, but a taxane, taxane versus taxane. Do you think it's legitimate to look at all this and say maybe patients with ER-positive tumors would be better off with TAC?
I think that we're making a lot of suppositions on the basis of single trials. And when you look overall, you don't see a pattern that one agent is specifically better in ER-positive versus ER-negative patients. The overview analysis, which has just been completed, actually, and won't be published, of course, for a while, although some of it will be presented, as I understand it, in San Antonio this year, basically showed that the addition of either an anthracycline or a taxane to a previous regimen conferred equal benefit in both ER-positive and ER-negative patients. So that would argue against the idea of specifically selecting to go to more aggressive therapy in ER-negative patients and not to do so in ER-positive patients.
You're talking about the meeting in Oxford that just happened a couple weeks ago.
That's right.
What did Peto, did he comment on this issue in terms of why, like, this TAC study showed it? Did he think it was a subset or, you know, random chance thing?
It was not specifically commented on, but of course that's the concern. The concern is that we're all looking into the tea leaves hoping to see something, and when you're doing that, you're going to come up with spurious correlations. I think that the paper in JAMA, which is the CLGB experience, was the most compelling because in the last 3 node-positive trials, this effect was seen. But as you pointed out, in so many of the other trials, this was not seen. So when you take it unselected just across the board, so whether or not in individual therapies this is true, it's going to be hard to establish. I think the results of NSABP-B38 will be really very important in this regard because there we'll get a prospective comparison of TAC and dose-dense therapy. And if reading the tea leaves is right, maybe TAC will be better in the ER-positive patients and dose-dense therapy will be better in the ER-negative patients. But that's something to be answered by that trial, for which at this time we are just supposition.
I'm much more skeptical about that. I think the problem with the ER thing is it's a false dichotomy. That is, if you do a two-by-two analysis and you throw in HER2 and ER, for instance, as Dan Hayes did at the CLGB update in ASCO, it's hard to see any benefit for adding taxanes to the ER-positive group when you do that. And none of the other studies have done the two-by-two work carefully. The second is that ER is a continuous variable. There is very, very little up to very, very high. And if you look at a lot of retrospective work from the IBCSG, the benefits of chemotherapy are minor in the very high estrogen receptor expressing tumors and quite pronounced if there's low. So we're trying to, because we have to, for an overview analysis, say, oh, yes, it's ER positive or no, it's not. But it's very hard to do that. And if you look at things like an oncotype assay, if you look at quantitative ER and response to neoadjuvant therapy, all these things suggest that there is a much more proportionality than you would expect. And my worry about B38 is that it's going to be every bit as boring as 1199. 1199, the Joe Sperano ran for the ECOG, was the fastest accruing trial in the history of the intergroup. We put 5,000 patients on because everybody wanted to give AC followed by a taxane, weekly Taxol or weekly Taxotere, and it accrued gangbusters. And 5 years later, it's the big yawn because you realize it totally missed the point. The point being that for the question where you really want to know, it's underpowered because there are relatively few events because most patients have ER-positive disease and they're doing fine. The reason why they showed the data prematurely is everybody was said it's already 5 years out. There's no difference whatsoever between these curves. The benefits of chemotherapy, if you're going to see them, you see in the first 3 to 5 years. You don't see chemotherapy benefits emerge suddenly 8 years down the road. And so it's a total wash. And the worry about the B38 is it's going to be for the vast majority of patients who have reasonably strong ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, it doesn't matter which chemotherapy you give. And then we're going to be parsing subsets. Okay, in the 28% of patients who had ER-negative disease, was TAC better than dose-dense AC-Taxol?
Although it does have the experimental arm of dose-dense ACT-GEM, so maybe that'll be interesting. Peter, unfortunately, I guess there's no Adjuvant Therapy for Dummies book, but I've heard this statement. Tell me if you agree or disagree. In general, the benefits of chemotherapy in ER-positive patients is about half of what it is in ER-negative patients. Agree, disagree, or in between?
Disagree.
What would you say?
I would say that the benefits of adjuvant chemotherapy, first-generation adjuvant chemotherapy in premenopausal patients are equal, irrespective of ER status. I would say that in postmenopausal, first-generation regimens are more effective in ER-negative patients than ER-positive patients. I would say that the overview suggests that when you add complexity to the regimens, that complexity adds benefit irrespective of age and ER status.
But sort of global,
and that's what the overview says.
But kind of global eyeball, how do you relatively compare the benefits of chemo overall, ER negative, ER positive? It sounds like you think it's closer than...
I think it's closer than some of these studies would suggest. And I actually think we're making the wrong arguments here. ER, it's the molecular target in the pathway for steroid hormone effects. Okay, it is not the major target. It's correlating with things that are important in that pathway. I think ER correlates with HER2, and HER2 correlates with topoisomerase 2. And I think that topoisomerase 2 is likely to be the major driver in a lot of what we're looking at. That wouldn't be true for taxanes, of course, but I think that we're looking at things which correlate weakly with other things, and we're seeing a weak signal. When we get the real targets, we will see really a good signal.
How? What's unbelievable to me is that we've been giving adjuvant chemotherapy for 30 years and we still don't have basic answers to these because we have used age as a surrogate for a lot of other things. Age is a surrogate for the biology of the tumor. It's a surrogate for menopausal status. And if you look at the overview, exactly as Peter said, in the update, chemotherapy across the board benefits ER-positive and ER-negative in the same proportional risk reduction as a function of age. So if you're younger than 30, younger than 40, younger than 50, you get a lot of benefit. But two things. One is that's proportional risk reduction. It is not absolute benefit. Because everybody with ER-positive disease raises the bar, the absolute benefits are always smaller. Second thing is we still haven't factored in menopause. Chemotherapy is very efficient at putting people into menopause. TAC causes 25% more amenorrhea than does FAC. And until we've figured out a way to normalize for that, it's really hard to interpret these studies.
Peter, what were your thoughts on the cardiac presentations at ASCO? We're actually doing a whole program just on cardiologic issues in breast cancer because, of course, we have the HER2 issue, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. One of the things that I think it was the SEER presentation showed was data based on cardiac risk factors, hypertension, diabetes, where it kind of went up. Did those presentations affect what you might say to a patient, 60, 65-year-old patient, long history of hypertension, diabetes, or even maybe cardiac history?
I certainly found the Sierra presentation very provocative because it did seem to show more cardiac toxicity than we have routinely thought would exist. Actually, I talked with Hyman Muss, who's taken serious interest in the older patients in clinical trials. That's a relatively small subgroup, but they haven't seen a lot of extra cardiac toxicity in the trial population. So the question is, why would you see more in SEER? There are a couple things to say about that. One is that it wasn't really consistent across the age groups. It was, as I remember, she did it by subset, and I can't quote which age groups it was, but there were some funny aspects to that. The other thing is you have to realize that it's a Medicare database. So you're really not looking at definite, you're inferring what's going on by what's being ordered for the patient. So that there are various kinds of biasings that could occur. One of them, for instance, if you know a patient has had anthracyclines in the past, you may be more likely to look for and diagnose certain kinds of problems. So I don't know we'll ever see this kind of data from clinical trials because, in fact, we recruit very poorly to older patients into clinical trials. But there are some older patient clinical trials going on now, and it's certainly something to be looked for. And I haven't changed what I would suggest to be done, but I think that it does reemphasize to me that patients should be told that there's a chance of developing congestive heart failure.
For the next segment of the program, several of the practicing oncologists from the Florida Cancer Specialist Group presented to the faculty challenging breast cancer cases from their practices, beginning with Dr. Scott Lunin.
This is a 44-year-old premenopausal woman who's in otherwise excellent health who was found to have a 1.1-centimeter invasive ductal carcinoma, ER-positive, PR-negative, HER2-negative. She's node-negative, sentinel node was negative. And I saw her in clinic yesterday, and we have computer terminals in the room, and we discussed actually the adjuvant online model, which we brought up right in the room. According to Adjuvant Online, with her tumor size being a grade 1 tumor, node negative, the odds were overwhelmingly in her favor. And then we discussed the role of anti-estrogen therapy, of course. And I think as Dr. Burstein pointed out, what is the role of chemotherapy for someone who's 44, has a small tumor that's a low grade, node
negative?
What
was her sort of attitude about the situation? What were her concerns, particularly in terms of chemo? How did she see that?
My sense is that she's more frightened of breast cancer than she is of chemotherapy, and her family is more frightened of breast cancer than of chemotherapy. So she actually surprisingly came in with the attitude that she wanted to do everything, and I really thought that she was going to fall into that, you know, that statistic that is often quoted, that 1% benefit statistic that I rarely see, at least where we practice demographically, we don't see younger patients. And so my job was to, I think, at least discuss with her what the data look like in terms of Adjuvant Online and what type of benefit we'd be looking at.
Peter, where would Oncotype DX fit into this patient's situation?
Well, I think that Oncotype DX could be used in a patient like this. Basically, it's designed, of course, for node-negative patients who you're going to be giving hormonal therapy to. Specifically, it's been developed in tamoxifen. Now, there are two aspects of the test. One is it could be used to take a look to see how it might influence your view of her prognosis. There are certainly discordances between classic pathologic information as viewed using something like adjuvant and Oncotype DX scores. I'm not sure exactly what you do if you get discordant values, by the way. I think the great hope for the Oncotype DX test is that it will be useful to identify those patients who might particularly benefit more than in an average way from chemotherapy. And so that story is, I think, very incomplete at this point. They're not making claims on their printout sheets that it does this yet, nor are guideline recommendations suggesting. And they have data from one adjuvant trial using one regimen, CMF, which you're not really thinking about using if you were going to be using a regimen in this patient. So from my point of view, you could refine things a little bit, but it's a typical internal medicine docs, give me some more information while I think about this. And you'd end up, at best, with discordant information. It wouldn't necessarily change your opinion.
How, in general, would you be thinking about Oncotype in a patient like this?
I love the Oncotype test for this kind of patient because this is exactly the patient population where we all have strongly suspected for a long time that the benefits of chemotherapy are very small. She has a favorable overall prognosis. The tumor is small at less than 2 centimeters. It is estrogen receptor positive, and I believe you said it was grade 1. So a lot of things of late have made us really question the role of chemotherapy. Retrospective analyses suggest that most of the gains are in hormone receptor negative disease. Prospective studies have shown modest benefits under any circumstance. If you look at NSABP B20, who she would have been a perfect candidate for, the benefits of chemotherapy on top of tamoxifen treatment alone are only on the estimate of 4%, and most women would have had larger tumors than she would have had with a higher grade. We know from a lot of other work that grade is an important predictor of the likely benefits of chemotherapy. So we've known a lot of this. And so this is the situation where you're talking about, would you take chemotherapy for a very, very small benefit, some of which might even be accomplished by ovarian suppression, especially in someone with a hormone receptor positive low-grade tumor. So historically, the dilemma has been that if you look at models of risk or if you look at clinical practice guidelines like from the NCCN, they say, oh, she's got a tumor greater than 1 centimeter, give her chemotherapy. And yet we all know that there's really, really small gain. So the way out of this box is a test like Oncotype DX. Because we've had all this information in front of us for a long time, and yet many of us have lacked the courage of our convictions to say to a woman who has a low-risk tumor like this, you don't need chemotherapy. I mean, that really is the crux of the issue.
So she gets Oncotype and she has a high recurrence score.
She's not going to have a high recurrence score because she's got a HER2-negative, low-grade tumor. And unless your pathologist is out to lunch, they're going to have a low-risk score. Now, it must be said that one of the reasons we've lacked the courage of our convictions is we don't all have fabulous pathologists. So we all sit around, you look and say, well, you know, I'm not really sure how much I trust the pathologist's interpretation of grade or testing and things. But what's going to happen is you're going to get a low or an intermediate score in a case like this. And at that point, you can go to the grids and it'll tell you that there is no benefit for chemotherapy if she has a low risk score. And there is possibly, you can't prove that there's no benefit for an intermediate score, but it's really, really, really small. And I find that patients both understand this intuitively and that they like seeing the quantitative numbers. For those of you who've ordered this test, you know that you get a piece of paper that has a sinuous curve on it, and you can plot out exactly what their risk is. And they understand that you can use this to both risk stratify and choose chemotherapy.
So why are you ordering the test if you know what it's going to show?
Well, I think that the dilemma is that the test is a spine-stiffening tool for the oncologist. We have often had all of this data in front of us, and yet we have not felt sufficiently empowered by the pathobiological data to make treatment recommendations based on it. And I think that, to its credit, tests like Oncotype allow us to feel more confident. And Peter makes all the appropriate points, which is that it's one study, it's B20, it's retrospective. But on the other hand, I think the principles of which patients really have tumors that are sensitive to chemotherapy or not are generalizable. And the second is that that's the same test, that's the same study for which we base all our recommendations. And so, you know, it's fair to say that, oh, B20 is only one study, but that's the test that would in the first place suggest you're even talking about chemotherapy with her, because where else are there data that tumors that are less than 2 centimeters really need chemo?
Would you use Oncotype in this situation, Steve?
I probably wouldn't use Oncotype. Actually, I would, again, try to go cheaper. And what I would use, and our pathologists are pretty good at doing this, is some measure of proliferation, an MIB1, Ki67 immunohistochemistry test. If it's done well, it's really pretty reproducible. In the old days, we used to have DNA flow cytometry and S-phase that was pretty reliable if it's done in a big lab. And I think this one, being low proliferation, I'd be very comfortable. And that makes up a lot of Oncotype. I mean, the proliferation.
Suppose
aspect.
It were high proliferation. Would you give her chemo?
Yeah, high proliferation, I would give her chemo.
Which chemo?
I would pick TC, oddly enough.
I got to say, I totally disagree with that.
Well,
because
good.
There are no data from any major prospective trials that the tests you just mentioned are validated for choosing treatments for patients. Zero, none. You can't find it. The power of the Oncotype data we have right now compared to everything else is that it has linked itself to the most important clinical trials in our practice, which are B14 and B20 for patients like this. And it's done in a totally controlled, absolutely reliable way. Please show me any data that any pathologist has generated from any specific center that shows that the way they do MIB1 or Ki67 or proliferation or S-phase is in any way reproducible, subject to all the vagaries of testing. There aren't it. It's absolutely insufficient data. That's why Oncotype has been, I think, so successful, because we would sit around a tumor board with cases like this, and then we'd have the exact same discussions. Oh, could our people do this? Could our people do that? You know, what about the grade here? What about there? And the trouble was, when you really came down to the decision-making, give chemo or no, most of us didn't have sufficient confidence in the actual testing done at our places that you could really make that decision. And that's where I think the Oncotype really helps.
Peter?
Well, I'd like to just add two things. One is that there are many trials that have included patients with small node negative tumors. The last overview includes a lot of patients with stage one cancer and shows the effectiveness of adjuvant therapy. So I think we shouldn't overemphasize that something that's done in B20 settles the matter. The second thing is I just want to bring some numbers back into the argument. And I actually think that we should have, and I would agree with you, that I would have been reticent about giving this patient chemotherapy because we have to remember the 0.5% risk of fatal secondary leukemia and other things, which begin to balance together with the other uncertainties about the long-term effects of chemotherapy against the small amount of benefit that this woman with a grade 1, stage 1 tumor is likely to get.
That was actually one of the questions submitted. What do you tell patients is the risk of myelodysplasia with AC? You say?
Well, NSABP says 0.3%. If you look at other trials, the numbers are generally a little bit higher from most of the other regimens. They're somewhere between probably 0.3 and 2%. And I think overall a consensus number somewhere, you know, 0.5% to 1% is probably a pretty good estimate.
Any guesses what TC would be?
I would say zero. There's no reason to believe that there's any excess myelodysplasia with Taxotere. I'd say zero.
Lowell?
Dr. Paik was here last night, and there's not complete concordance between all of these assays that there are some women that look low risk on St. Gallen criteria, on Adjuvant Online, on NCCN, that he did find, at least in B20, were higher risk on the Oncotype DX. So I don't know if you can completely use these other ones to throw out Oncotype and say you wouldn't do it.
I think, weren't you telling me, Steve, that there was a study done looking prospectively on how often Oncotype changes your clinical thoughts or what you expect? It was about 25% of the cases.
Well, the Rocky Mountain Cancer Center group has done a prospective study of how often Oncotype changed their opinion. It isn't prospective or it was right or wrong, but it changed their treatment management about 25% of the time when the test result came in. Now, whether that's right or wrong, I don't know.
Scott, can you follow up with the patient?
Yeah, we decided that we were going to send Oncotype DX.
What are you going to do if it's high?
Well, do you want to?
Yeah, Bill. Yeah. Bill, what does he do if it's high?
I'm going to call. I'll call Dr. Harwin.
We'll call Dr. Harwin.
Ironically, I want to mention, because I had two recent cases, and exactly as Skip was saying, I was really using the test to find a way to feel comfortable not giving chemotherapy. One was a 46-year-old premenopausal. Her tumor was about a centimeter node negative, and I send the Oncotype DX, just assuming it's going to be fine, and it comes back high intermediate at 27, 28. And the second, another patient, 54 node negative, also both were grade 2s, I sent the same test. One was 27, one was 28, both in the upper range of the intermediate range. At that point, I gave dose dense AC times 4. But I don't know what for sure is the right answer there.
Well, can I just go back? I'm looking at Adjuvant Online right now. A 44-year-old with a 1.1 centimeter grade 1 ER-positive tumor actually has an 18% chance of recurrence, according to the model.
Yeah, but run it for mortality. I mean, mortality.
Well, survival. Okay, but I mean,
18% chance of recurrence.
Recurrence. And the benefits of adjuvant chemotherapy in this model, in addition to hormone therapy, would be 3.5% to 4%. And I believe these numbers entirely. The dilemma is that it's an average. And the guess would be that there are going to be people who get more benefit. And if you have a higher score, as you know, the proportionality of benefit goes up in proportion to the score. So these patients you're testing probably merit chemotherapy, or at least strong consideration of it. And by contrast, some women really don't need it at all.
The next case was presented by Dr. Martin Nicolau.
This is a 42-year-old premenopausal woman. She actually constituted the third woman in her early 40s that I had seen within the last year who all knew each other. She obviously knew their stories and what had gone on with them. She was initially diagnosed with what appeared to be a multifocal ductal carcinoma in situ. She was a highly motivated lawyer and decided that she wanted just to put this to rest and decided to undergo a bilateral mastectomy. At the time of surgery, they found a 1 millimeter focus of invasive ductal carcinoma. It was grade 2 disease, but lo and behold, her sentinel lymph node showed a 0.8 millimeter focus of disease. She was subsequently seen in an academic center, and they made a case that this was part of BMT, benign mechanical transport, and they thought this really wasn't a positive lymph node. She was ER positive, PR negative, and she was positive for HER2-NU by FISH with an amplification ratio of 6.7. She comes to me and says, what should I do?
Was the micrometastasis seen on routine H&E processing or by special stains?
It was actually seen gross. It was on H&E. It was not.
Could anybody comment on BMT?
I was a nurse in surgery for 37 years before I became a nurse practitioner, and benign mechanical transport is another term for surgical seeding. Those surgeons who choose not to isolate the tumor factor within their surgical field and they reuse a clamp or reuse the instrumentation when they have taken out a lump and then they go into the axillary to take out the lymph chain can very well benign mechanical transport right into that area.
I was told it was part and parcel of the actual biopsy technique, and the force that was used with aspiration could passively push small focus of a disease into the sentinel lymph node. My problem was I couldn't figure out anatomically how a 0.8 millimeter focus of disease could be passively pushed into a lymph node.
What was the time frame between the biopsy and the removal of the sentinel lymph node?
Same day, she had the mastectomy, and at the time of the mastectomy, they took a sentinel lymph node.
Really challenging.
The questions are, do you offer adjuvant chemotherapy with or without Herceptin, and do you really believe the case of this BMT? And it's hard to know what to do with this micrometastatic lymph node when her disease really measured only 1 millimeter in her breast. I had them go back and extensively go through the breast, and they could not find any other occult disease.
Harold?
We're lucky in breast cancer that we can even think about the differences that less than 1 millimeter of cancer might make. So I guess that's great progress for us. And obviously, the case defies any easy characterization. We have a weekly tumor board where we sit down in a multidisciplinary fashion with our pathologists and surgeons and radiation oncology colleagues, and there are several stock cases. DCIS with a microinvasion, DCIS with a micrometastasis in a lymph node, endless obsessions about borders, those kinds of issues. So this is stock case number two, which is the microinvasion, micrometastatic disease. Sometimes it's really helpful to look at the lymph node because the worry about these artifactual cases is that they are artifacts, that they are not biologically significant metastatic disease in a lymph node. And sometimes you can get a feel for that based on how it really appears in the lymph node and what the look is and if other lymph nodes are positive. So the first thing I would do would be an axillary dissection, because if she had extensive other residual disease in her lymph node, then you would be far more inclined to consider this really breast cancer as opposed to an artifact.
Has she had an axillary dissection?
She did have an axillary lymph node dissection. No other lymph nodes were involved.
Okay. So now you're stuck, and you've got to decide in your heart of hearts whether you think this is biologically, clinically real cancer in the lymph node or not, and just treat her as you would. And that there's no...
So if you felt that way, based on talking to your pathologist, et cetera, would you treat her?
Well, you know, so the current guidelines parse out these micrometastatic deposits in various ways. More than 2 millimeters is a real involvement. Less than 2 millimeters, but some threshold, 0.2 or something like that, is sort of unknown significance. Less than 0.2 millimeters is considered node negative. So she would have a real 0.2 to 2.0 millimeter deposit of unclear significance. The most important thing for her is tamoxifen. The second most important thing for her might be ovarian suppression. The third and fourth most important things for her might be chemotherapy and or trastuzumab. And I'll let Steve and Peter tell you what to do with that.
Steve, what do you think you'd be doing in this patient? Assuming your pathologist said, yeah, I think this is really a met.
Well, I think this is a med. I think this is a patient with node-positive disease, and I would offer her one of the standard chemo trastuzumab options.
Peter?
This is one of those cases that we would discuss in tumor board, not come to a conclusion, you know, dogmatically to any specific conclusion. Basically, I think you could defend either. For this particular case, with such a small primary, I would probably not treat her. But I could make a defense for treating her.
To her credit, she was one of these people that you like to have this type of case because she was willing to go and do the research herself. She was very realistic and could weigh her options, and she could make a good decision on her own about what her risk was and what that benefit was and help me decide what was good for her.
So what has she decided, or you don't know yet?
That was about 4 or 5 months ago. actually decided to treat her with 4 cycles of dose-dense AC, and then I elected to try to give her Q3 week Herceptin. It was plus or minus whether or not there was a benefit, and ultimately she decided to make that decision. The benefit would be is getting the AC has pushed her into a postmenopausal state, and the clock is on for my time to convert her from the tamoxifen over to an aromatase inhibitor.
Let the clock run for a while, by the way.
Right. It's a year. Yeah.
Well, no, it's longer. It's actually longer. You know, we and others have recently published some case series where women in their early 40s who had treatment-induced amenorrhea who were on tamoxifen for even a couple years then redeveloped ovarian function when they were transitioned to an AI. So let the clock run for a while on that.
That's another one we could spend an hour on. Question right here.
Was the HER2 testing done on the intraductal component or on the microscopic invasive component?
Good question. Had it done on the lymph node itself because of the DCIS being positive commonly for HER2.
The next case was also presented by Dr. Lunin.
This is a 77-year-old white female, otherwise healthy, who was found to have a 3-centimeter invasive ductal carcinoma, was ERPR negative, HER2 new positive by FISH, and she was found to have 2 out of 12 nodes that were positive in her regional lymph node dissection, and she came to me for discussion of adjuvant therapy.
Can you talk a little bit more about her, her lifestyle, her general health, and her attitude?
She's otherwise healthy. She really has minimal comorbid conditions. I don't think that she was paying particularly close attention to her breast exam, but I wouldn't call this a neglected tumor. She had fairly large breasts. And she, I think, was stunned at the concern I had with regard to breast cancer mortality in this older patient. And in this particular patient, she's more terrified of chemotherapy than she is of breast cancer.
So Peter, just plugging her numbers in or thinking about the issue of comorbid mortality in a 77-year-old woman, how would you think through the numbers in this case?
A 77-year-old's going to have like a 25% 10-year competing mortality, even if she's in good health. However, here she is. She's node positive, HER2 positive, ER negative. She actually has a more substantial risk of dying of breast cancer than of dying of something else. So this is the kind of patient for whom one might really seriously consider treating with chemotherapy despite her age. And we all know the uncertainties. There's uncertainties about how good chemotherapy is in older patients, but there's no biological reason to believe that it isn't effective. And I know what's coming up here, and at least in part the temptation is, what do you do if she refuses to take chemotherapy in terms of giving her trastuzumab?
Or even just offering it to her as an option, trastuzumab without chemotherapy. Steve, would you consider that in this patient?
Yeah, I would. I think it sort of comes up in all of these discussions because what you've indicated is she's kind of leaning. She's terrified of chemotherapy. She's older. She's much more likely to have toxicity from the chemotherapy. But a year of trastuzumab by itself might be relatively benign. There's no data, but we all kind of see the effect of adding trastuzumab to adjuvant chemo. You could come up with a less than a standard regimen if you wanted to give her 12 weeks of paclitaxel on a weekly basis. That's fairly non-toxic type of treatment in addition to trastuzumab. Be a little creative here. I think you'd like to probably avoid AC. TC might be an alternative, but again, an older patient, she's going to potentially have a little more toxicity from that. We are going to be doing a pilot safety study of TC plus trastuzumab, but we don't have the data. I know a few oncologists have used that regimen in sort of lower risk patients. So I think there are a number of choices, and what I'd like to try to do for is at least get her some trastuzumab as the very minimum.
Harold, you're going to be looking at that regimen that Steve talked about, paclitaxel and trastuzumab. Can you talk about that?
The tumor board cases we frequently get are about relatively small tumors at this point. You know, the tumors that are ER negative less than a centimeter or ER positive 1 to 2 centimeters, is it worth adding trastuzumab? And we don't have a lot of data from the outcomes for those women. They were excluded from the North American trials and relatively few in the HERA trial. So we have planned to run a trial, a multicenter study, where patients who have stage 1 breast cancer that's HER2 positive would, as their chemotherapy program, receive 12 weeks of paclitaxel and then a year of trastuzumab. concurrently, so 12 weeks and then an additional 40 weeks of trastuzumab afterwards, with the goal of setting a relatively low bar, say a risk of recurrence of no more than 5 or 6% after 5 years, and just demonstrating in 300 to 400 patients that you could achieve a very low risk of recurrence with a reasonably well-tolerated regimen. So that's something we hope to undertake. This is obviously a different case. The median age for treatment in the adjuvant trastuzumab trials was between 45 and 50. There are not a lot of people living in South Florida who went on to these studies at age 77. So it's very hard to generalize about the safety experience. We do know that age is a predictor of cardiotoxicity in the trastuzumab trials. Peter, I think, is updating adjuvant with version 9 or 10, which is going to have HER2 built into it. But in today's iteration on the computer, it's not available. And her risk of recurrence is 50% over the next decade, and her risk of dying of something else is 27%. So if she tries to buy insurance tomorrow, the insurance agent is going to be much more worried about her breast cancer than he is about anything else. So I think a reasonably aggressive regimen, it makes some sense if you tell me that she really is playing golf every day and fishing at night and out with her grandchildren 7 times a week and all those kinds of things.
What specifically?
Well, that's where you have a lot of flexibility. I think that people like this can tolerate AC and T, though it's not a trivial regimen. I like the idea of a weekly paclitaxel regimen.
What are you using in your younger patients? You mentioned you use dose dense and HER2 negative. Are you using dose dense trastuzumab?
We usually play it pretty much by the book with that, which is we typically give the AC every 3 weeks and then the weekly paclitaxel because that's where we have the safety data.
So this woman, and remind me, did she have a cardiac history or risk factors? I think she did, right?
Yeah, she has some hypertension.
Hypertension. So how this woman says...
So hypertension, by the way, is also a risk factor for cardiotoxicity in the update from the NSABP experience. So if you throw in hypertension, then we'll give her a major medical comorbidity. And at that point, she now has a 55% chance of dying of something else over the next 10 years, as opposed to a 25% chance. So again, I think, you know, look, this is where you have to know your patients and you have to be a good doctor and really think through how much can this patient tolerate and what's it worth.
So she says to you, doctor, if I take Herceptin alone or Herceptin plus paclitaxel, what's my chance of cardiomyopathy? Or if I decide to go with an anthracycline and a taxane, the whole deal, what's my chance of cardiomyopathy? What do you say?
The honest truth is we don't really know. The risk of monotherapy-associated cardiotoxicity in the HERA trial, for instance, was less than 1%. But those patients all had an ejection fraction of 55% or greater at baseline after they'd had chemotherapy. Again, I think you can make some reasonable choices here, whether you focus on a taxane, whether you focus on a well-tolerated anthracycline program if you have it. The hard part here is, does she really need all this treatment or not? You can't point to data to tell you which way to go.
What happened with the lady, Scott?
This was not one of those cases where I felt comfortable sending her to the hospital for a MUGA just to kind of get a sense of what her cardiac function is. For me, it sort of asks the question, how do you really define adequate cardiac function in someone who's 77? So I discussed the case with a cardiologist, wanted her to have a transthoracic echocardiogram, even a stress test just to make sure that there weren't any reversible ischemic changes, no valvular disturbances. And then at that point, discussed with her what Dr. Burstein was talking about in terms of using an anthracycline. I think I'm leaning more towards weekly paclitaxel combined with trastuzumab followed by additional Herceptin. I'm concerned about using an anthracycline in this patient. Ultimately, I'll let her make the decision based on what the cardiologist finds.
Well, you have the TCH regimen available to you, which obviously has proven efficacy. And the dilemma is, again, many of us find that to be a relatively toxic regimen. And I'm not sure that's something that the elderly might tolerate all that well.
One of the most discussed topics in breast cancer clinical research relates to the next generation of adjuvant trials for patients with HER2-positive tumors, and one major international study, the so-called Aphrodite trial, will evaluate the role of the dual tyrosine kinase inhibitor, lapatinib. This four-arm study has become controversial because in one arm, patients receive only lapatinib as anti-HER2 therapy, as commented on by Dr. Jones.
I think that study will be easier to do in Europe than it would be in the United States. So you'd have to think long and hard before you put a patient on that where she might not get trastuzumab since there's such a benefit there. On the other hand, I think the data suggests that it's probably going to be as active, but we just don't know that. And adjuvant, we're talking about the potential for cure. So I think in this country it'd be a hard sell.
I'd be curious from some of the people around the table, would you be comfortable putting a patient on that study? Would you be selecting out maybe borderline patients who you weren't even sure you wanted, you know, 1 centimeter tumor? Lol, I see you shaking your head no.
I would just have a hard time because of the tremendous benefit of adjuvant Herceptin with putting a patient on a study where they might not get that. I'd be much more comfortable with an add-on. Or what the patients don't like is the year of continuation after the chemotherapy. So for some part, I would be comfortable in getting it. But getting no Herceptin whatsoever, I would personally not randomize a patient to that.
A question there, Scott?
I just wanted to ask the panel members about circulating tumor cells and, A, whether or not they believe in that technology, and if they do believe in it in the metastatic setting, whether or not there's any role to believe that it may be helpful in the neoadjuvant setting where you still have a tumor burden that's in the body and whether or not that may help define what the best regimen is, at least preoperatively.
That's a great question. Do you see circulating tumor cells in the neoadjuvant setting?
I never order the test. I believe the technology. That is to say, I believe that if you have the leukemic phase of breast cancer and you can find circulating cells, and I think they can with these very rare events, that that's probably not a good thing, and that it probably does portend a worse prognosis. But the dilemma is that there are not data as yet to suggest that small changes in the burden of circulating tumor cells are sufficient for making treatment changes. So switching from one chemotherapy to another or instituting chemotherapy when you would not have otherwise. The other dilemma is that there's a much older literature looking at bone marrow micrometastases from Braun and people like that, and they've shown that the presence of micrometastatic disease in the bone marrow is an adverse prognostic factor, which of course makes sense. But the curious thing is that not everybody with that develops metastatic breast cancer. In fact, a lot of those patients who have immunohistochemically detected cells in their bone marrow live 25 years without recurrence of breast cancer. So it probably isn't good for you, but how bad for you it is not clear. And again, the real issue is it therapeutically helpful? When they updated this at ASCO, they showed these data that if you had more than 5 circulating tumor cells, you were more or less doomed, that you were going to be dead within a year no matter what happened. And I guess I don't actually find that kind of data particularly helpful for patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.